we approach the Maryland Film Festival, once again, we talked to a number of the directors and actors and filmmakers who are part of this, and we have, once again with us, Marshall Curry, who, of course, did If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front, Street Fight, about Cory Booker, Racing Dreams, and he's now the director of a new film called Point and Shoot that won the Best Documentary Award at Tribeca, the Tribeca Film Festival. And of course, he's been nominated twice for Best Documentary and for an Academy Award. And Marshall, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
So I guess you now decided you're going to make your career doing documentary films.
Well, we'll see. Take them one at a time. It's a hard slog.
Documentary films are a hard slog, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I mean, I love it. It's getting to sort of go into worlds that I don't know about and share those worlds with people making movies is great, but it is hard to raise the money, and it's hard to they're not easy. They're not easy to make.
Right. I think people don't realize that, and I think that what it takes, it's tenacity, and it takes, and you really have to, because you're focusing in on a subject like this one we're about to talk about for a long time to get the film done.
That's right, and you know, trying to structure it in a way that will feel to an audience like a movie rather than, you know, a lecture that they might get in school.
The last thing you want to do is have a documentary that sounds like a lecture. But so,
yeah, they have a bad reputation from years past. But I think more and more they're really just nonfiction movies.
So this is a fascinating one, and I had the good fortune of watching it online. I can't wait to see it on the big screen. So you found this fellow, Matthew Van Dyke, who actually grew up in Baltimore, and was in Baltimore during your shooting of it, living here, and just lived this life of an adventurer, though, with all kinds of weird things around him. Tell me how you even, stumbled on the story and met him.
Well, he actually found me, which was interesting. He just emailed me one day and introduced himself and said that he had recently returned from Libya, where he had gone to join the rebels who were fighting Gaddafi, and that while he was there, he had had a camera and had some amazing footage of this experience and also of the experience that preceded it, which turned out to be a three-year, 35,000-mile motorcycle journey that he took through northern Africa and the Middle East. I thought, wow, this is a pretty dramatic story, and so he and his girlfriend, who's also in the film, came to New York and met with my wife, who's my producing partner, and me, and we just listened to them tell this incredible story. And it's a story of transformation. When he was young, he had been sort of sheltered and coddled, as he describes it, when he was growing up, and after graduate school, he decided that he just needed to go on what he called a crash course in manhood, and set off on this journey that eventually led him to Libya, where he was captured during the war and spent 5.5 months in solitary confinement in this horrible 7-foot by 4-foot Gaddafi prison. Anyway, the story was so amazing, and the footage that he had shot was incredible. And I decided that it would definitely be worth making a movie about.
And it was. I mean, I think his footage plus your interviews with him and the way it was edited together, I mean, it's a very compelling movie. And because it also, it's a film that it's just so different and original, because you're following this guy who says he's obsessive compulsive. He has to disorder, has to wash his, you see clips of him in the movie washing his hands and arms. And I often wondered that, you know, when he was going through the Middle East, how his OCD affected him, you know, as he was going through the Middle East and Libya and the war in Iraq.
Right. And really not the most sanitary conditions,
yeah,
fighting in a war,
yeah,
in Libya. I think it was a big challenge for him. And in fact, that was part of the reason that he set off in the first place is that he has this very serious diagnosed condition of obsessive compulsive disorder. I think a lot of us who don't know somebody with it think of it as meaning, you know, you need to keep your office neat. But for him, it means a very serious fear of trash cans, a fear of, you know, people's shoes. He explains that it's hard for him to drive a car. He can't really drive a car because if he hits a bump, he'll start to think that maybe he hit somebody in the car, and 20 or 30 miles down the road, he'll turn around and go back just to check to make sure that he didn't hit somebody. He can't have any sugar or anything sweet like honey or syrup in his apartment because he feels contaminated if he gets sugar on him. So all of that, I think, made him feel helpless in a way, and he decided to try to take control of his life. And part of that was throwing himself into a world where he knew he wouldn't be able to control, you know, whether he got sugar on him or whether he was near trash. And I think he thought that some extreme exposure might help cure him of his OCD. So that was part, I think, of what drove the crash course in manhood, as he says.
It's amazing to watch him come to Gibraltar and then go across the water and go across North Africa and into Africa and into Iraq, and you know, getting himself credentials to be press inside the war in Iraq with troops. I mean, his whole story is when he describes himself in the beginning as being this kid who was deeply infected by Lawrence of Arabia and all these adventurous kind of stories, even though he was kind of meek and mild on his own, other than his fantasy level, he was really living out his fantasies for real.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And if he didn't have the footage, there are many parts of it that I think maybe somebody wouldn't believe.
But, exactly.
But I've watched, you know, a couple hundred hours of his footage, and it's all there.
When you approach films, it seems like a lot of your films are built around a person that tells a larger story. It has a larger social picture to it, but through the eyes of a person. I mean, that seems to be how you like to focus your work.
Yeah, that is. I mean, when he first approached me, I explained that the only way that I would be willing to work on the film is if I had complete creative control. So,
uh-huh.
You know, I got to make all those decisions, and he agreed to that, you know, from the very beginning. And there were a number of things that really interested me in his story as he described it. You know, there are so many questions that the story raised, and hopefully that the film raises as well. Questions about, you know, how we become adults. Questions about violence and war. Questions about how we should live our lives. You know, should we stay home and watch things on television? Should we go out into the world? What's the difference between being brave and being reckless? And a lot of questions about the way that we craft ourselves using our cameras. You know, in the footage that he had shot, he was making a conscious effort to recast himself as someone different from who he had been when he was growing up. In some cases, that even meant, you know, taking on a new name, as he described, sort of a tougher-sounding name. He, in some of the footage, he would call himself Max Hunter. You know, what was interesting to me about that was it's really a phenomenon that so many of us are doing today with camera phones and Facebook and Twitter. The use of cameras and images to create public personas of ourselves is something that really, I feel like, should be examined. And this is this film is, I think, an entertaining way of generating a lot of those questions. The conversations that I've heard audience members have after the film is over are really exciting to me. It's not a polemical film that answers questions. It's a film that tries to generate conversations that people can have over dinner after watching it.
On a number of levels. I mean, I think that one of the things that struck me about him and this film was when he's on this initial trip by motorcycle across North Africa. He goes to Africa and meets this Libyan, runs into him. They really like each other, hang out, though they're very different. So his sense of loyalty, he describes later in the film how he didn't have a lot of friends growing up, but then when he finally gets to Libya and meets these people, he feels like he's found a world of people who he really loves and are friendly with, and they mean something to him. But before that, he meets this guy from Libya, and he has a sense of loyalty that may be partially driven by that and his own kind of madness, and we all have it at one level or another, but his own kind of madness. He has to go back to Libya to be with those people, to stand against Gaddafi because of this deep sense of loyalty he's gotten.
Right. I mean, he explains that these friends that he made while he was in Libya were the best friends that he'd made in his life. And so when the Arab Spring started, and at that point it looked like America wasn't going to get involved, and NATO wasn't involved, and Gaddafi's troops were just rolling over the rebels, one of his friends said to him, you know, Matt, why is nobody helping us? And so that day he bought a plane ticket to Libya and told his girlfriend and his mom, going to Libya, and actually the plane ticket he bought was to Cairo, and then he went overland from Egypt to Benghazi, but just decided to put himself out there.
So tell me what you learned from this. This young man who has to go find himself, and I was also surprised that, you know, the woman stayed with him. They're still in love. They're still together, which is great to hear, given all they went through,
and right.
because of his own obsessions. But, you know, going through Iraq, Afghanistan, the war, learning how to shoot, telling these stories, going back to Libya, imprisoned. So tell me your sense of him that you walked away with from doing this film that you might not have even thought about when you started.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting to me because he had told this story to us, and when he told it to us originally, it was a 3 or 4 hour conversation. And after he left, my wife and I just couldn't stop talking about it. There were so many issues that it raised. And when I was younger, I used to hitchhike a lot, and I loved the process of, you know, being tossed into somebody's car, a total stranger's car, and having a conversation with them until the next stop. And you know, it would bring me in contact with people who sometimes I agreed with, sometimes I didn't agree with, but I always felt stretched by those experiences with people. And I think that's what drives my interest in documentaries too, is just spending time with people who have amazing stories. And so we decided that the film would simply be him in his apartment in Baltimore telling this story and intercutting that with the footage that he shot. It was a very simple premise. It was not going to be, you know, a 60-minute style investigation of Matt Van Dyke. It was just going to be, hey, audience, hop in a car and ride with this guy for 82 minutes, or when you meet somebody on a bus or you meet somebody in a bar, and they just tell you an unbelievable story, an incredible story, which also happens to be illustrated with some beautiful and powerful and sometimes scary and sometimes funny footage. So that was the goal, and that people would walk out with different opinions about the choices that he had made, with different opinions about how what it says about the way that they're living their own lives, and hopefully they would walk out stretched a little bit and continue to kind of argue with each other and wrestle with some of the questions that he raises.
And I think some of the biggest questions to me, as I said earlier, was it does make you want to talk about what people are committed to, what our moral obligations are to whether it's a person we love or to ourselves, the people we've met. The fact that the Libyans he met were just as equally nonviolent as he is a human being, but they were caught in the midst of this violence. All that was part of the story. You know, I when I first heard of him a while back, I wasn't sure to believe all of this stuff myself, but then watching this film, I was just had to sit down and realize that this was a, you know, that we want to kind of create, sometimes society wants to mold people into, so we can all be too similar, that we lose this edginess and this edge that many people have. But it was the fact that he had this edge that allowed him to do what other people would think was mad.
And I think that there are still people who walk out of the movie and half of them think that it was brave and noble, and half of them think it was crazy and reckless. And you know, that's part of what I love about the story, that when you meet somebody who's done extraordinary things, it forces you to ask questions about the way you're living your own life and the choices that you've made in your life. You had asked earlier what were some of the things that surprised me. One of the things that I mentioned a little bit was the way that we craft images and images of ourselves. And in the film, Matthew does a lot of that himself. You know, there are shots where he sets things up and he's talking to the camera. But what really struck me was the way that other people were doing the same thing. And there are almost no scenes in the film that don't somehow touch on this question of filmmaking. And when he was an embed in Iraq, the American soldiers would ask him to film him looking like soldiers. They would ask him to film them looking like soldiers, even though that's what they actually were. They couldn't simply just be who they were. They needed to think about their image and to control their image. And I thought, oh, this is just an American obsession. But as you see in the footage, and as Matt talks about, when he got to Libya, the Libyan fighters were the same. And my expectation was that guys who are fighting such a, you know, dangerous and high-minded fight, you know, they're risking their lives to rid their country of a dictator, that these same guys would also want to have their pictures taken with big guns so that they could post pictures on Facebook and send pictures home to their, you know, email pictures home to their girlfriends, and that they would be influenced in the way that they were shooting guns by Hollywood movies that they had seen. All of that kind of, I don't know, like circular feedback loops of media and the way that we're part of media, and then we're influenced by media, and then we're creating media through Facebook. all of those questions were just fascinating to me, and also fascinating that they weren't just an American obsession. They seemed to be a human obsession.
And I think you captured all that in this film, and it really keeps you watching. I mean, you're I must say, Marshall Curry, you're an incredible filmmaker, and I appreciate the work you do, and I'm so happy that you always bring it to Baltimore for the Maryland Film Festival. I really mean that.
Thank you so much. I love the festival, and it's always great to be there and to be able to meet people and hear their questions. So I'm looking forward to coming down and doing a Q&A afterward.
All right. Marshall Curry, he's directed this film we're talking about, Point and Shoot. Two-time Academy Award winner, nominee. One day maybe a winner, I think.
That's right.
Point and Shoot will show at the Maryland Film Festival on May the 9th at 11 a.m. and May the 10th at 2:15 p.m., both at the Walters Art Museum. You can get more information and buy tickets at md-filmfest.com. And we'll have that on our website as well.
People can also take a look at the film's website, which is Point and Shoot Film. And that will, they can take a look at the trailer and find out a little more about other screenings we're having.
Perfect. Marshall, thanks so much for your time, and congratulations on this film.
Thank you very much.
We're hearing Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division. The British band play will be the last gig with singer Ian Curtis on this day in 1980, 2 weeks before he killed himself. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.